Live from the heart of Los Angeles, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show. With tonight's guest, brand architect and impact CEO, Josh Jost.
Look at the night sky. Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Hope Easton. I am Mark Legere. And now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
I like to do a funny thing sometimes during our recalibration workshops. I like to ask the attendees, who here knows anyone who's always negative, like who always seems to think a negative thought, either about other people or themselves? And invariably, almost everybody will raise their hand almost all the time. And I then like to turn the conversation around and the meaning around. And I say, well, not me, actually. Everybody I know is positive. In fact, everybody I know is 100% positive. I go on to say things like, there's this one person I know, and he's 100% positive that if he had a few million more dollars, he'd be happy or he'd be set for life. And there's another person I know, she's 100% positive that if she married this wealthy person, that her life would be so much better. I know someone who is 100% positive. I say that if they were able to own that car, yep, that car, the dot, dot, dot. And another person who's 100% positive that if he had whatever career, if he became a this or that, his life would be very different now and for the better. And when I say 100%, it's not a hyperbole. I actually mean 100%. How do I know this? Because I've spoken to so many of these people and they're 100% convinced, like there is no room for doubt that that would make them happy or that that would make them successful or that would have made them a better life. And if we start to say, well, we don't know if, yeah, but no. So that's why I say 100%. Now in my career as a singer and as a life coach and as a workshop leader, and especially on the Life Changes Show, I've gotten to not only talk to a lot of people, I've gotten to know them very personally. So with all those people and all that information that I have, see, the problem with the theory of the 100% thing is that I know the person who has that $1 million or several $1 million, or in some cases, a billion or more, literally. I know the person who has a particular sports car or two or three of them, or literally a couple dozen of them, literally. I know the person who has that career and the person who made that career choice or who has that beautiful wife or handsome wife or wealthy husband. And you know what? They're also 100% positive that if such and such would have happened, that their life would have been better. If they could only afford a yacht, or if their yacht could be bigger, or if they got a divorce, they would be happier, or if they got to marry, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, especially in the workshop, the recalibration, there's great potential in the hopes and the dreams, and dare I say, even the illusions. And in the recalibration, we look for patterns and we look for ways that we get to use all of that and see why we want these things. And if they still mean the same thing to us, and what do they mean to us? How can we come to have them, or when and where do we want them, and time frame, et cetera? Not until actually today, I think, until I started connecting and conversing with our guest, did I begin to see the possibility that this disillusionment that we're talking about might actually be a pathway to enlightenment. I can't wait for this conversation.
This conversation, tonight's conversation, I think is going to be one of our more important ones, because I believe that although our guest's story is intense and extreme, it's relative. And I think everyone can resonate with it in one way or another. And I know I've faced disillusionment so many times, and being able to embrace that and then look and listen to where Josh has taken it in his life and the lives and businesses that he touches. It's going to be a great conversation.
Indeed. And so we've titled this episode, our 806th episode, Embracing Disillusionment on the Way to Enlightenment. Our featured interview guest is a brand architect. He's an impact CEO. He's an intuitive strategy advisor to executives and Fortune 500 companies. Welcome Josh Jost to the Life Changes Show.
Hey guys, thanks for having me here. I feel like this is my big moment. They always told me I had a face for radio, so I'm glad to be here.
You look good too.
Thanks.
You heard what you inspired me to share, and I know you know all those people. As a matter of fact, maybe you were all of those people.
You tell me. A little bit at one point or another in my life. Yeah.
Now, how did it manifest for you, some of them?
Well, you know, I guess I started out with, you know, big aspirations in life. I think, like, you know, a lot of young people my age growing up in middle-class America, being told you can do anything and thinking that I could go out and conquer the world and, you know, getting out and finding some hard knocks and realizing that, you know, maybe I couldn't conquer and do absolutely everything, that caused me to reevaluate. But the story, I guess, goes back a little bit before that. I was raised in a very conservative Christian community called Mennonites, mostly in, I was born in the Midwest in Kansas, but they had a community in Central California. So I spent quite a bit of time there growing up. And you know, if you're not familiar with the Mennonites, they're a lot like the Amish. You know, we're kind of two branches of the same tree. The Amish went slightly more extreme with the horse and buggy, you know, sort of ditching cars and all of that. But they were still, both of them, very, very conservative communities. And so I grew up in that context. And, you know, as we were raised growing up, we kind of were told to believe that we were special and unique because of our religion, because of our beliefs, that, you know, we were God's special people, and we were supposed to be very, very happy because of, you know, our religious path. And I remember having a distinct moment in high school when I kind of looked around. I was at a Mennonite high school, again, in Central California, and sort of looked around at some of my friends and classmates. And I thought, you know, as much as we talk about being happy, I wasn't sure if anybody really was. I knew, you know, for sure I wasn't. I was quite miserable, actually, and sort of feeling like this weight of all these expectations, you know, upon me, as often happens in that kind of community. And so I say my first taste of disillusionment was that, you know, I started to become disillusioned with our religion and with what we had been taught, and started to question things. And, you know, I think a lot of us would be terrified to question that, because, you know, what's the cost of that? You become, you know, potentially disenfranchised from the entire community if you do. But I just knew I wasn't happy, and I wanted to be happy. And so I decided that either this was something that was worth giving everything to, or was worth giving nothing to. And I decided that I was going to give spirituality a try first and see if there was anything, you know, to it. And so I started spending every night, like after school in my room, after I'd finished my homework, I'd spend every night sort of 2 or 3 hours meditating, just asking the, you know, the divine or the ever-living for some sort of real tangible experience that was meaningful, and, you know, that I could really build my life on. And several weeks into that exercise, that practice, I had an experience that was, you know, a kind of an awakening experience. I had this sort of sense of energy flowing all through my body and this sort of vibration and this feeling of just complete ecstasy come over me, and I was completely changed. But I knew it wasn't the religion that got me there, it was that spiritual journey. And so I started a kind of new path on this spiritual journey. I was still inside of Christianity at the time, trying to explore and find what this meant and delve deeper into this. And over the course of years, I began to, you know, continue to have these experiences. And I think it sort of slowly over time began to kind of lead me out of organized Christianity and that whole sort of belief system paradigm into a more open view of spirituality. But it wasn't an overnight experience. But I would say along the way, there were many times in my life where I began to become disillusioned with some aspect of my life's expectations. You know, I met and married quite young, and I had these expectations about what marriage would be, and I was going to have this perfect, happy marriage. And it turned out to be not the case, and I became disillusioned with that. I had some career aspirations that didn't work out and became disillusioned with those. And I think, you know, there's a sort of natural reaction that we have when these experiences happen and we begin to, you know, feel that fear of disillusionment. You know, it's that fear of the unknown of, well, what happens if all of this that I've built my life on is not true? What does that mean for me? And I think people react to that in different ways. Some people will go into some mode of escapism to try and avoid those doubts and those questions. Other people will sort of double down, you know, on their, you know, what they know and try and sort of hold on to it, not face the fears and the concerns. For me, I've always felt that the best way to do it was to face it head on and just say, okay, there's something here that doesn't work, and I want to know what the truth is. I don't care what the consequence of that is for me personally. I need to know what the truth is. And I think in almost every aspect of my life, I walked through that sort of journey of disillusionment. And it kind of hit a major turning point for me when I was several years later, I had married a woman that I met in Scotland, in Hawaii, who happened to be from Scotland, and we moved to Scotland together and we started a family. I had come to a point where it just felt like nothing in my life was working. My career wasn't working, our relationship wasn't working. In fact, we had hit the crossroads and decided to separate, and I just felt like everything around my life was crashing down. And I remember taking a walk. I was living in the Highlands of Scotland and took a walk, went along a river and through a forest. And I remember at that point, I became completely disillusioned with life itself. I didn't know what was on the other side of it. I wasn't suicidal. I didn't want to, you know, end my life. But at the same time, I just didn't have any will to go on living. I just was completely, thoroughly disillusioned with life. Nothing in life seemed to turn out the way that I anticipated it would. And I remember very clearly that day walking down this path through the forest, and it was just something in me that just let go of all expectations of life, let go of all of any sort of interest toward, you know, trying to sustain or better myself or anything. I just completely, just everything let go. And I remember having this moment that I would describe as kind of being like the movie in Avatar, where, you know, they sort of step into that world and all of a sudden everything is luminous and glowing and coming alive, and there's this life pulsing through all the plants and everything. And it's exactly how I felt walking through this forest. It was almost just like my own identity just drifted away into the background. And it was just the whole forest just came alive, and I could just feel this incredible energy going through everything, through the plants and the trees and the birds. And it was just, and I was one with it. There was no separation between myself and everything around me. And I found this incredibly profound peace that has stayed with me for for the most part ever since then. It's not said I've been that way 100% of the time, but for the majority of my life, I've been in that state of just complete peace with life, just letting go of those expectations. And I began to realize that enlightenment is not the journey of attaining something as we often think it is, you know, trying to develop some perfect spiritual practice and virtue and so on and so forth. Life is just about letting go of our illusions. And the more that we let go of the illusions of how we've attached our identity to this or that or the other, the more that we become awake to the reality that's always there. It's a bit like Wizard of Oz, right? You can always go home. You're always home. It's like that reality that's always there. We're just asleep to it because we're so caught up in the drama of our everyday lives and the expectations about what it takes to be a good husband or wife or partner, son or daughter, a good employee, a member of your community, your church, your synagogue, whatever, you know, roles we play. We're so caught up in the drama that we can't see the incredible reality that exists beyond that. And that is simply the path of enlightenment. It is just opening up to that, using that disillusionment as a gateway into a greater reality. And I struggle to find anyone who's ever gone far in spirituality that didn't start out with some type of disillusionment in their life, whether it was with their career, the relationship, or whatever, politics. That was always a starting point. And I realized that that, more than anything, is just quite simply the pathway to finding our true identity, our true selves.
I could just see you going, or somebody going to a like a yogi or something and saying, or a minister, well, no, a yogi, saying, I'm disillusioned, and them saying, good, now we can start.
Exactly. And exactly. And the one that shows up, you know, with, you know, I'm dedicated, I'm going to give my all to this and all that sort of thing. And the yogi goes, yeah, you're not ready yet.
So
come back when you're ready.
There's a book there. There's a book.
Maybe.
There. Yes. Yeah. Yes. 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 Yeah. So it's a good thing to be disillusioned, and yet we have to make it through the disillusionment, because that part, that has its own work, right?
Right. And the first one's always the hardest, you know. That's the first, is the sort of cracks in the wall, the tear in the seam that, you know, starts to really shake your perception of reality and your perception of yourself. As you progress, you begin to not just not fear it, you begin to anticipate it. You begin to look for it. And, you know, some of the greatest spiritual teachers that I've found love finding these little nooks and crannies of their own disillusionment and bringing it to the surface and having a laugh about it. You know, and finding these moments where it's like, oh, you know what? I got caught up in being a great yogi. You know, how silly was I? Let me let go of that illusion. You know, I got caught up in being a great humanitarian, right? And so you start, because it's like every time you do that, it's just like you just take off another layer. You just shed another layer. You drop more of that weight that you're carrying, and you just find yourself becoming more free. And it's a beautiful place to be, you know, not worrying about what are people thinking of me and what if this happens and what if that happens. It's like you just let it fall away.
So let's say the person who got caught up in wanting to become a great yogi and how silly was that, let me just let go of that. And when they let go and other things happen and they learn other things, and eventually they may actually become a great yogi. So is the passion or desire, that's not necessarily wrong, right? Initially.
Yeah, so that's really interesting, because the word passion actually means to suffer.
Oh.
You know, and yeah, it's, if you look at the original meaning of the word, it means to suffer. And,
oh, wow. Like the passion of Christ. I never put that together.
Literally the suffering of Christ. That's where it came from.
Wow.
And it's that process of suffering, which is, it's the dying of the ego self, ultimately. That's where the suffering exists. When there's no ego left, there's no suffering. There's physical pain, sure, but, you know, the suffering goes with the ego identity. And so when you walk through that process, and this is what's interesting about, you know, when people talk about finding your purpose, I often say to people, you know, your purpose, you know, there's some great models out there that are useful, you know, Ikigai and things like that. But I often say to people, your purpose is buried in your suffering. When you look at where you have suffered the most in your life, that is usually where your gift, where the pure gold of yourself exists. That's your gift to offer the world. And it's only by journeying through that, that you uncover who you really are and are able to then use that as a gift to others. And so that suffering is an important part. And I think one of the challenges with a lot of, you know, quote unquote, modern spirituality, the sort of commercialized fast food spirituality is, you know, you're teaching about, you know, manifestation and law of attraction and all of that, which, you know, it's true. These are principles that work. There is power and reality behind them. But when you're teaching that the measure of your spiritual greatness is your ability to manifest things into your life, what happens is you're not dealing with the ego. You're not dealing with that part of you that wants to avoid suffering. It wants to avoid that disillusionment. And so you often see people hitting the walls when, you know, or seem coming off the rails when they've tried that and they thought, oh, I can manifest my perfect relationship and my perfect career and all of that. And it didn't work. And then they start questioning themselves and going into a tailspin thinking, well, you know, what have I not been doing right and so forth. And sometimes life's just saying, hey, you've got a bit more work to do here. You know, this is the point of this is for you to grow and for you to become the gift. The point of this is not for you to come and live some perfect life and avoid these lessons and these journeys, these challenges. It's actually to embrace those. And then through that, you find the life that's on the other side. And, you know, the greatest, you see the, you know, the yogis in that, in the Eastern tradition, you know, and the Western mystical tradition, they didn't teach these things until the students were quite advanced in their spiritual development, because they knew if they gave them these tools too early, it would inflate the ego and it would actually derail the spiritual journey. And so it's important that we embrace that journey. We embrace that path of suffering, not for suffering's sake, but because we want to find the reality and the joy and the peace and the happiness that's on the other side of it.
How much of this knowledge would you say comes from your spiritual practice, and how much of it comes from having grown up in a religious community, having had financial hardship, having lived in drug-filled slums, and having and continuing to work with heads of Fortune 500 companies and billionaires?
It's a good question. I think, you know, the religion kind of gives you the form of things. But it doesn't replace the experience. It doesn't replace the direct learned experience. Mm. The way I like to describe it is when you're a child, you go to school and you see children playing. What they're learning to do is they're learning how to be adults, right? They're watching, what their parents and other adults around them are doing, and they're emulating that through their play, through, you know, pretending to, I don't know, be a chef or drive a car or build something or, you know, I don't know, design clothes for dolls and become a fashion designer, whatever. It's all practice. It's all play. But it's all preparation for a real experience that exists beyond that. And sort of school creates that kind of learning experience. Sort of religion creates that sort of learning experience like a school that teaches you about metaphysical ideas and concepts. But at some point, whether that's within the context of religion or whether that's moving beyond it, at some point you have to see beyond the trappings of religion into the reality that exists beyond it. And that's often why when people sort of have some kind of spiritual awakening, they find operating within established religion quite difficult and constraining, because it's like they've grown up and they've sort of graduated and they're now ready for the reality that's beyond it. And so I think, you know, I often sort of plumb back through my days in, you know, when I was in the religious past, of what I learned from the Bible and the concepts in there, and I glean ideas and concepts from it. But often they're informing the experience that I'm having, the real lived experience in spirituality. They're not opening me to it. They're informing what the experience that I'm living. I still have to live that experience first and foremost. And then you find the aha moments where your understanding catches up to what you're living and experiencing. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of how I approach it.
It makes sense. And it's interesting that they both seem very important. And which is interesting because you also started in life in a community. Like there is no more community, I would say, probably, than what you described. That is community. Now, you might not have liked what the community, or felt comfortable with what the community, the restrictions of that particular community, but we are headed towards community. So how do we, in your opinion, or why is that important? And how do we do it righter?
I like that. How do we do it righter? Let's see. I think that's a book title.
Nice.
I like that. So, yeah, I mean, you know, again, sort of looking back on my past, I look back on school with, you know, affection and affinity at the same time that I look back on my past with affection and affinity. There was a real value that I had to living in a small community where, you know, I could walk into town and everybody knew who my grandfather was, and my parents and my uncles and aunts, and, you know, you felt like you belonged and you felt like you were part of something bigger than you. And I think that's one of the things that we're missing so much in the modern world, is that sense of community. And I think the word community is somewhat diluted in the modern world, because we talk about community a lot, but I don't know if we actually think of community in the same way that ancient cultures thought of community. And this is something I spent quite a bit of time researching and looking at. I actually started really, and this became a lot of the sort of business consulting that I do, is I started looking at human belief systems and how they work and how you form community. Because we're creatures of community, we're creatures of belief systems. It shapes every aspect of your life, whether you're in a formalized belief system such as a religion or whether you have more of an informal, internalized belief system. We all have built our lives on systems of belief. And even if you go through this disillusionment, the belief system, being aware of your belief system is important. It's the same thing as when enlightenment, you know, it's not like the ego just all of a sudden goes away. It's still there. It's just that you're conscious of it and what it's doing. It's not driving you anymore, right? So it's like growing up with a belief system and becoming conscious of it. You see the value in it, and it's not, you know, it's not the dictator anymore of your life. And so every, you know, companies have belief systems. We call it culture. Political systems are belief systems, and so forth. But, you know, circling back on the community idea, when the ancients spoke about community, and we're talking about tribal cultures, it was really much more like an extended family. You know, they were, everybody was an aunt and an uncle. Everybody was a brother and a cousin, whether by blood or direct blood or not. There was a sense that they were all one family, that were pulling together and working together. So there was a sort of unity consciousness that existed in these tribal cultures and still exists in many parts of the world today. I mean, I live in Tahiti in French Polynesia, and, you know, here tribal culture still exists in many ways. And you see, you know, everybody's an aunt and an uncle. And, you know, the whole village raises the child. And there's, you know, no such, like, there's no scandal about, say, children born to a single mother, because it's like the child belongs to the village. And it's not, you know, the end of the mother's freedom and life and enjoyment because she's had a child and now a slave to, you know, her job and child rearing. Everybody rallies around to raise and support the child as if it's one of their own. And when you see that kind of real community, that kind of real human connection, you look at it and go, this is what we were meant for. We are creatures built for this. And this is going to be such an important part of our growth and evolution as humans, that we learn to dwell together in real community. And whether that's in, you know, physical neighborhoods, whether that's in virtual communities, whether that's in companies that develop affirming, life-giving cultures, we need to reclaim what community looks like and feels like and acts like for consciousness to really thrive on this planet. It's I'm convinced it's the next step, and it's where things are heading in the years to come.
So, Josh, this is on the other side of the disillusionment of, I don't need anybody, I can do this myself, I'm a self-made person, look at me kind of thing, right?
Right. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, in the corporate world, we talk a lot about leadership, and you know, you look at the studies that, you know, all of the focus on leadership has actually created a lot more problems in many cases than solutions, because it's sort of, we've set out the kind of hero leader sort of paradigm in the corporate world, and therefore everybody wants to be the hero leader and nobody wants to serve. Because we've said, you know, we've said, whether you're in the community or maybe you're an influencer, right? And it's how many followers you have, and your measure is your influence, right? And so we've said, okay, to be somebody of meaning and value, it's not about how much you're serving others, it's about how much you're recognized as a leader in whatever domain.
Yes.
And when you move past, and leaders build monuments, leaders create armies. Servants build communities. And I think we'll see a new paradigm. I'm hoping we see a new paradigm of servant leaders who, you know, aren't leading out of that ego success mindset, but are leading with a passion, dare I say the word, to build community, with a passion to bring others together, to build bridges, to build families, to create connection and consciousness. That's the kind of leadership that we need to see emerge, which is oddly not about leadership, it's about serving.
Wow. Well, thank you for serving by sharing as you have. We're coming towards the end of our conversation. We just got a couple more minutes left, and I know you have great expectation and excitement for the future. I think it's interesting that you have a perspective of who we are and how we feel about ourselves, how we know ourselves, going into that, as to whether it is exciting and a dream or a nightmare. Could you take a moment to explain that, at least tease the idea?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we're in a place where we're seeing dramatic change happen all around us. And if you're someone who's set your identity on the sort of ego systems, the ego-based systems, where your identity is based upon your financial success or your relationship success or your social standing or your social media following or, you know, any of these sort of external measures, when we start to see these systems really shake, which I think, you know, we are already seeing these things happen, and I think we'll continue to see this happen for a few years. It's going to be a bumpy few years before things, you know, we come out the other side. When if your identity is attached to those things, it's going to be a terrifying ride. But on the other hand, if you are on that disillusionment journey and you're doing that inner work and you're letting go of those external attachments to find your real identity, I think it's going to be one of the most exciting times to be alive on this planet, because we on the other side of this are about to see humanity emerge in a way that's much more divine, much more loving, much less ego-driven, more servanthood and community and brotherhood and sisterhood and all of those things that will be coming on the other side. And if you're preparing for that and you're doing the work now, it'll be an exciting time because of the experiences that we will have seeing these things emerge. It's like a birthing process, and we'll be excited about the birthing process on the other side. If you don't know there's a baby coming, you're just, all you're seeing is suffering. But if you know there's something on the other side, it's pain, but it's not dire suffering. It's hope and expectation. And I'm really excited about what's coming for this planet. I think that, you know, the seers and the prophets of old, Nostradamus or whoever, like, they've looked forward to this time. They've seen this time coming, and we get to live in this period, which is tremendously wonderful.
Josh, this is Mark. Really, really well spoken. And, you know, the fact that we're living through this paradigm shift is magical, to say the least. But what your other words about leadership have been just ringing a bell for me. And it called to mind one of our avid listeners a few years back brought a title back into my consciousness that I think is relevant to what you were saying, and maybe relevant towards, you know, a focus going forward, which is servant leadership. Mm-hmm. And it also crosses over to the idea of not waking up other sheep, but waking up other lions, right? The more that we're leading from a place of service and inspiring others to serve as leaders, and that letting that ripple continue to change, which will then, you know, affect each community.
Beautifully said, Mark. I agree with you. I think, you know, it is that true, you know, true leadership is service, you know, in its truest form. You know, and I think of somebody like a Nelson Mandela, who, you know, maybe tried to begin with out of the ego, went through his disillusionment phase, you know, in a terrible incarceration, and then came back as a servant who brought a nation together. I mean, it's the most beautiful comeback story ever. And I think it's a picture of our journey in, you know, smaller ways for some of us.
You know, and this no better time to give a shout out to Damari Bond-Lintel, who from HQ Social, that introduced me to you and to the Life Changes show, and talk about leading from a place of service. Damari's a perfect example.
Damari lives that. I've never seen somebody with a bigger heart to give, all the charities he's involved with, all of the work he's done across LA. I mean, you know, when there's a forest fire or a major earthquake, he has a house in Hawthorne that's a converted hangar that just becomes a distribution point for aid that goes out everywhere. I mean, he's a living legend, and I'm grateful that he brought us together as well.
Josh, you called it when we were talking earlier, this was one for the long form. But so if we had more time, we could delve on so many things that you touch on that someday will either be a book titled Who Knows What or a movie. But in the meantime, there are many movies all over YouTube. You've got a channel. We've got one of your pieces up on the Life Changes show page for Josh Yost. That's J-O-S-T. So J-O-S-H-J-O-S-T.com for Josh Yost directly. Or I think we have Why Relationships Don't Work. There's a title. So you can go to the Life Changes show and see that, or go directly to his YouTube channel. We have his links to TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, etc. Find him there. Josh, thank you so much for sharing as you have, serving as you have.
Guys, it's been a joy and an honor to be with you today. Thank you for bringing me on the show.
Our pleasure. Until next time, all the best, Josh. Josh Yost. Josh, J-O-S-T. Find him at Josh, J-O-S-H-J-O-S-T.com. And with that, we have our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Donald, and I live with constant pain. My friend thinks you can help me, and I pray that this is true, and I am ready to do whatever I need to do to feel better. I have excruciating neck and back pain. I also have diabetes and serious allergies. Due to accidents, I have torn tendons and ligaments in my shoulders and lower back. I have arthritis in my neck, back, shoulders, elbows, hands, wrists, knees, and feet. The pain has become overwhelming, and I moan and groan day and night. Please help me.
Dear Donald, thanks for reaching out to me. It is important for you to know that all dis-ease begins in the emotional, mental, and spiritual bodies before finding its way into our physical bodies. Thankfully, there is a way to heal yourself if you are willing to do the work. I lovingly suggest that you begin by reading Louise Hay's amazing book, You Can Heal Your Life. After you have read the book, go to the center of it and look up each of your challenges. Louise gives you a probable emotional cause and then provides a new thought affirmation to say, and this assists in shifting the energies to healing. I would start with accidents, since you've had many of those. Louise suggests that the probable cause is inability to speak up for the self, rebellion against authority, belief in violence. And Donald, I intuit that this is very true for you, and that Louise's new thought pattern will assist you in stopping the accidents. The new thought is, I release the pattern in me that created this. I am at peace. I am worthwhile. And then next, please find the probable cause and new thought patterns for each of your body parts that are painful. Once you have looked them all up, please write each of the new thought affirmations down and then start and end each day by reading them out loud and thanking the universe for supporting you in manifesting your healing. Donald, this process really works, and I know that it does because I used it to get out of a wheelchair and be able to walk again when the doctor said I would never walk again. So, dear Donald, once you begin doing the work, I look forward to hearing of your getting better and better.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if you have a question for Dorothy, please lovingly write her at askdorothy@lifechangeshow.com.
And we'll be right back with our performance guest here on the Life Changes Show, Hope Easton, right after this.
The Little Dog That Could is the fantastically true story of a man and a little dog that came into his life as his mentor to help him understand the world beyond his human senses and to experience life, love, and healing beyond his human understanding. Best-selling author Filippo Voltaggio, who currently hosts the highly regarded Life Changes show, is an internationally known singer, speaker, and life coach. Filippo offers up his own story, how one little surprise package in fur and four legs transformed his life unexpectedly forever and furthered his path of self-discovery. In The Little Dog That Could, Filippo brings to life the meaning of the adage, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Through the reading of this book, you will experience the journey of real miracles that transcend time, space, and logic while gaining practical tools that will help you navigate your way. The Little Dog That Could is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For more information, visit thelittledogthatcould.com. That's thelittledogthatcould.com.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening, someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within. Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
You are listening to A Conversation That Matters on The Life Changes Show, broadcasting live from the heart of Los Angeles every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Share the journey with us at lifechangesshow.com. and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Life Changes Show.
We are back, and our performance guest is a cellist, a singer, a songwriter. She's a chamber musician. She is so much more. We're happy to have her on the show. Hope Easton, welcome to the Life Changes Show.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure, and a big thank you to Marina Manoukian, our mutual friend, for introducing you to us.
Right.
You know, after that conversation, like, I know you and I are going to get into it and enjoy, and the audience is going to get to enjoy not only your music, but your energy that you bring across when you share. I almost feel like starting with a song, because Wonderless kind of puts a button on what we've just been talking about, doesn't it?
I think so. I think everything you were talking about, from disillusionment to hope and expectations, I'm like, I can talk about that all day long.
Right? Right. So tell us about Wonderless. We'll hear it, and then we'll jump into the next conversation.
Let's hear it first, and then we'll talk about it. How's that?
Okay.
Can we do that?
We can do that, sure. It's your show. So with that, here is a pre-recorded Hope Easton's song, Wonderlust, on the Life Changes Show.
Do I have words written down to remind me of the thoughts I have found? Feelings, their feelings, all along. Wonderlust, wonderful, wonder what it's all for. Wonderment, wonder as. Do you have faith in the stars? They're part of you, and that's what we are.
That's what we are.
Feelings, stardust feelings. From the start. Wonderlust, wonderful, wonder what it's all for. Wonderment, wonder as, wonder as.
Wonder as.
I have so many words written down. Words are feelings come alive. Wonderlust, wonderful, wonder what it's all for. Wonderment, wonder as, wonder as. Say, will it be grand and make my day? Words and feelings are the same.
And there it is.
Oh,
Wonderlust.
Yeah.
Olé. Oh, okay. So, gosh, where do we start? So I'll just go ahead and say Hope Easton. And Easton is E-A-S-T-O-N. You can find her on the socials. You can also find her on the Life Changes Show page. Hope Easton, she has her official Facebook page. And also, you could find her at hopeeaston.com. So, Hope, you have you picked up the cello. Why? I mean, actually, how you say you're petite, and you
I
picked
am.
Up the cello. Why?
Why exactly? Because I had a mother that's like, you're playing that. I'm like, okay. I mean, I am the fourth of four children, so violin, flute, and guitar were already taken, and kind of piano. So my mom was looking for a trio. She seriously was. She wanted violin, cello, and piano. So she got at least me. My sister with the violin didn't go too far, but she's a really good singer. So everyone's pretty musical.
So you picked up actually the piano first?
Well, I played around. Like, I don't even remember knowing that I read one. Like, I have pictures of me playing piano. So cello really was my first instrument.
So hold on. So you have pictures of you playing the piano, but you don't remember those. So it's before you.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know what I was playing. Maybe I could read some notes. I probably could read some notes because we had a nice, you know, baby grand or grand piano, actually.
Oh my God.
I probably could play something one hand at a time, you know, that kind of playing.
So with that much music, actually not just music, but arts in general, right? In your life, you had a lot of influence in artistically.
I did. I had a mother who was just not just a pianist, but an artist. And then eventually my stepdad was actually in the Cleveland Orchestra. So I kind of grew up with the Cleveland Orchestra. I was there like every week. I was ushering at a very young age for the concerts.
You have pictures of it, but you don't remember?
No, I remember. I mean, it was a lot of concerts, so I don't know if I remember them all.
So all of that musical influence, and so you're playing the cello, and what I know you say people do it. I haven't seen anybody do it that I recall, but the cello and singing, how does that work?
Right, it's kind of complicated. Well, I think maybe because I quit at some point. I quit the cello. I sold my cello, which is unheard of because I ended up buying it back like 6 months later. And when I bought it back, I ended up playing with a singer that was like, she was with Hollywood Records, this English girl. And I played with her. I just played cello like I was improvising, and which I had never done as a classical player. And then like a year later, we went on tour. And I said to the guitar player, I'm like, how do you write songs? She's like, I don't know. You just try. And I'm like, okay, that sounds good. And then I just started writing songs, just the melodies with no instrument. And then I took some the first songs I wrote, I took them to my brother, who's a really good guitar player in San Diego. And I have to actually get those songs out of the closet. They're there somewhere on a tape. I need a tape recorder. Anyway, and then I started playing guitar. So it took me a while to attempt singing with the cello. But then someone said something to me and I'm like, oh, let me try that.
Well, there's
more. First I was like, no. First I was like, you can't do that. It's impossible. And then I was like, well, let me try.
Well, it's kind of like tapping your head and rubbing your belly or something, right?
It's kind of tricky. It is. Because you're using your elbow. That's the big giveaway. That's a lot different.
So fingers are okay if you're on a guitar, obviously.
Fingers and piano, it's a little bit easier. I mean, I don't know how drummers do it because they're using their feet too. So that's super talent. Wow. I mean, I can use my feet to change things too, but it's harder on the cello and singing at the same time.
You were saying that that's why sometimes violinists or musicians, they make funny faces because why?
Because in the brain, that's where your mouth and your fingers are together. That's where they're located, right next to each other.
Wow. That's interesting. And the elbow is connected to the fingers?
It's further out there, you know? It makes it more complicated.
Oh my gosh, it's so complicated. Actually, it's kind of complicated like a 3D life.
Exactly.
Talk to us about a 3D life. This is your latest single that's come out.
This is my most recent single because, you know, once you write a song, you still have to produce it. And that takes time and money to do that. So I wrote this for my niece who got married. And it's kind of like there's like some inside jokes in the song. And I think it's probably like my, I don't want to say happiest song, but maybe lighter song. It's not so heavy like Wanderlust.
I thought I got the whole song. Now I'm trying to think if they're inside jokes, then what did I actually get? I'll have to listen again. So we're all
some people
listen.
Didn't. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're not that inside. I spell it out pretty clearly, but
Okay, well, we'll get to all hear it together and figure it out. This 3D life, this is a 3D life pre-recorded by our guest, Hope Easton, here on the Life Changers Show. I had to wait till the last bell at the end.
Bell, the church bells, right?
Right.
Hope that was kind of trippy on Easton. My side. I'm getting like, sometimes it was going faster and sometimes it was cutting out.
Oh, really? Like, no, it yeah. sounded good to me.
Maybe it's just on my end. Something. Oh.
Well,
gremlins in my computer.
I was visualizing like, that's a good exit song. Like after, you know, the marriage ceremony is over and the groom and the bride, you know, going down the aisle happily ever after outside. Yeah.
Someone asked me, did somebody ask you to write that song? One of my musician friends. I was like, no, but.
Yeah. Very cool, Hope. You know, actually, we're going to get to hear one more song of yours. But before we do, you know, speaking of cool, you know, what's really cool. I actually asked you three times, three different ways, not because you weren't getting it, but because you were getting like you answered differently, but the same way each time, or different ways, but the same thing. And I'm like, this is so cool. Like I wasn't testing you, but do you know what it was? Cause I was asking you three different ways. I asked like, what's the coolest thing you've done? And I need to explain to the audience if they haven't seen your bio, like she's worked with everybody on all the shows that you see, the music shows, the this, the that. I don't need to mention it. They're there. Oh, you know, American Idol, The Voice. I mean, so that kind of stuff. She was working with classically Josh Bell and, you know, Pop, Adele, and all these people in all these places. And I asked her, like, what's the coolest thing you've done musically? She's like, you say it.
Well, playing my own music with like a band, like performing my own stuff. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's great. I did play at the Hollywood Bowl recently, and that's pretty just a fantastic venue. I mean, I wasn't performing my stuff, but that would be really great. But yeah, I've done a lot of stuff with the cello for sure.
And so what I was getting from that, and that's what I was getting at is that you like that conversation that's had on stage with an audience, right?
Well, I think I feel like I do have quite a bit to share, even if it might be, you know, dualistic and mental and emotional. I mean, that's what music is, kind of, right? You're kind of a seer and a speaker, and you're getting all kinds of downloads, I would say, you know? With someone sharing information. And I do like to perform. I'm a pretty good performer. It's fun. Yeah, because you're like, you know, what do you do all this stuff by yourself? And, you know, it's great to write by yourself, but then you want to connect with other people.
And it's interesting, when we were talking about being in a studio, that was the thing that excited you most too, is that connecting with people that are fun and creative in a studio.
And well, that's like the patchworking of music, where you can create harmonies and other instruments. And
yeah. And then that was the last thing I wanted to get at with this conversation, is that something else I thought that was cool is that in the studio, you can make it perfect.
Exactly.
Interestingly enough, though, in a live experience, you said
you can't. I mean, can I say that F word? If you mess up,
no.
You know what I mean. If you mess up, that's part of the fun of like performing, because you know I don't really like being perfect. I mean, I'm not perfect, so you know, to have like a perfect, I mean, there's some people that are like, look at these classical people, OMG, they have to be kind of perfect, but it gives you more chance to, you know, just be, regardless of if it's perfect or not, you know?
It's kind of like life.
Yeah. You're not always happy, right? I mean, it's just, we strive to be happy, but you know, life will be like, really? Here you go. Take that.
No.
And you'd be like, I'm not so happy right now. You know.
Well, what kind of a note are we ending on? We're gonna get to hear.
We'll end on a stars. You know, something about the stars, because that's my other favorite thing in life is the stars. Yes.
Stars in the sky, of course, we're talking about. And these stars are falling. What do we say about, like, what do you want?
This is, I don't know. I mean, you know, a lot of these songs I haven't really listened to. Accidentally, I heard Wanderlust the other day, and I was like, oh, that'd be good to send, because I had a really nice MP3 of it. And Stars Falling, I actually wrote this with someone else who I've written, yeah, I would say like a good maybe 10 songs. Not that they're all recorded, but so he's a colleague, friend, and he's actually playing piano. So when we get together, we usually write something.
Should we mention his name?
Yeah, sure. Leo Chlyapov. Another Russian. I have a lot of Russians around me.
Yes, and a mutual acquaintance, actually, Russian.
You know Leo, too? Everybody knows Leo. No.
No, not Leo.
No, Maxim.
Yeah, Maxim.
Maxim Velichkin.
Velichkin. Yes. He's been on the show as part of a quartet or a quintet or something? But
oh, cool. Well, we had a band, and we kind of are still, like, we just got together the other day, but we need to get a show. But it was Hope and the Russians. That was the original name.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah.
But it's hard to control that ego, the two egos of Russians. Oh, no, 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 no. Anyway, I did pretty well, though. I got an album out of it, so, you know.
Nice. Nice. Well, okay. Well, here is Hope's pre-recorded song, Stars Falling, on the Life Changes Show.
I'm walking in distant lands. I see you're doing the math. Can make no sense of things, or if justice prevails. Is it we're meant to be? Or living in a simulated fantasy. You never know when things just might take off like a horse running wild. Stars falling from the sky. Full moon in late July. A kiss goodbye along the sand.
Olé.
Olé. You like that.
I was too busy writing down the lyric. Do you remember that September? And I was thinking when Hope Easton was on the show.
There you go.
The right life changes show.
I love it.
Hope Easton, EASTON. So hopeeaston.com. And she's on Facebook. And Sonos Chamber Players. We didn't talk about that group.
But that's my chamber music group.
Yeah.
So all kinds of everything, pop, classical, jazz, different combinations, lots of strings, but, you know, pretty much anything.
SonosChamberPlayers.com. I hope to catch Hope and the Russians, Hope and the Italians, Hope and the Germans.
Let's stick to one grouping. Maybe in different places. That'd be great. Hope and the Russians in Italy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Hope on the Life Changes show has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For sharing your music and your passion with us. And I look forward to getting to see you live.
That would be awesome.
And with that, a big thank you to Hope Easton and another big thank you to our guest, Josh Jost. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Lejour, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at The Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.